Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The most important battle spaces in that war, arguably, is the home front. And in the home front, the developments that are taking place involving our capital markets and businesses more generally are of surpassing importance. A man who has been hugely successful in those areas for many years has now turned his attention to helping the rest of us understand what's going on in that domain. His name is Charles Mizrahi. He is the driving force behind Alpha Investor, and that is one of America's fastest growing investment publications. He has some 40 years of experience on Wall Street and is a formidable contributor to our understanding what's going on there in his podcast, The Charles Mizrahi Show. Mr. Mizrahi, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Great. Thanks for having me, Frank. And please call me Charles.
Thank you, if I may. Let me ask you about wokeism, a term that is now being bandied about a lot, but I'm not sure most of us really understand what it is, let alone what it portends, especially in the context of woke capital. Can you walk us through that quickly?
Yeah, sure. So I'm not a deep thinker on these things. And you just look at the surface and you see what is the definition of how wokeism is being used. Really, what the official term, if you look at Wikipedia, for example, woke is a term, awareness of issues that concern social justice and racial justice. What wokeism really is censorship. It's bullyism. It's making people cower in fear if they said anything, and I said in the past 20, 30 years ago, it's brought up to them, and their reputations are destroyed, their livelihoods are destroyed. And it's, in my opinion, it's basically an attack on something we all hold dear, and that is freedom of speech.
I'd argue that it's freedom more generally, in a way. It's kind of a Marxist totalitarian enforcement of the party line, and you're right, it definitely affects speech, but it affects so much more. And witness what's been going on lately with so-called woke capitalism in the context of the state of Georgia adopting legislation. We'll be talking more about it in the course of the program, I think, but to make clear that it opposes what the people of Georgia, through their elected representatives, have decided to do to try to assure electoral integrity in the future. Talk a little bit about how that's playing among the public at large and consumers as well, if you would, Charles.
Yeah, well, I can only speak from my perspective. How it plays out in the rest of the world, you know, it's a different ballgame. But from my perspective, it's pretty simple. Certain companies, Coca-Cola, for example, Major League Baseball, Delta, and I think it's pretty significant about Coca-Cola and Delta because they're both based in Atlanta, Georgia. In fact, Coke was born in Atlanta. And they came out against, which is just silly. Corporate America, really these three companies, had a say in what was discussed, debated, argued, voted on in the Georgian legislature. It's even funny to speak about, right? It's like, here it is. We have the process of government in place. And all of a sudden, corporate America, these three corporations saying, well, we don't agree with it. You're a company. Your objective here is to increase your shareholder value. It's not to go in and give your political opinions. In fact, I would say, and I see this as clear as day, it is going to work against them because money talks. And the majority of Americans, a large majority of Americans, are against this censorship and this wokeism and this attack on freedom of speech.
I've seen a Rasmussen poll specifically, Charles, that talks about 60% of those polled saying they think you know, corporate America ought to stay out of politics. And some 37% said they wouldn't buy Coke as a result of this kind of activity. So there can be real costs, presumably, to them. But I did want to ask you about this, because one of the things that's been so unsettling as we watch what's going on in corporate boardrooms is this phenomenon known as environment, social justice, and governance, or ESG, which seems, talk about, you know, totalitarianism, it seems as though it's now being enforced by the power, notably, of a company called BlackRock, which has some $7 trillion under management, and of a lot of it in some of these corporations, and it's telling them what to do. It's telling them what their corporate policies should be, what their board of directors membership should be like. It sometimes even saying, you know, you need to change your entire business model if you're in, for example, the fossil fuel business. Is that the logical extrapolation of what you're talking about? And how ominous a problem is it for business and the country, for that matter?
Well, there's two very important yet hard to answer questions. I'd like to tell you that how it plays out is it eventually will peter out and will stop at some point, because my belief is the American people are a freedom-loving people. We don't like bullyism. We are always on the side of the oppressed. And if we're ever on the side of the bully, we're on the wrong side. So here, to me, let's just call this for what it is. It's really bullyism, telling me what to do, telling my company what to do, telling my board of directors what, which is just, it's funny, I can't even say these things, this is so outrageous, what ethnic backgrounds, what colors they should be. Gosh, isn't corporate America about increasing shareholder value? Isn't a board of directors supposed to be comprised of people that can really watch the CEO and watch the boardroom and act as the shareholders' representatives? I don't care what color or what ethnic creed they are. If they're the right person for the job, who cares? We shouldn't care. We shouldn't care. We shouldn't make it a matter of such discrimination based on a person's color or where they're born.
But Charles, what we're now being told, as I understand it, is that that's kind of passé, that shareholder-focused capitalism. We're now into stakeholder capitalism, which may not be capitalism at all. But how is this likely to play out if the public is not, you know, in favor of it, and some consumers at least are going to punish companies that engage in it? Will we get back onto that more traditional footing, which really is the cornerstone, isn't it, of free market capitalism?
The answer is yes, right? So no one has ever made money shorting America. No one has ever done well underestimating the American people. This too shall pass. We had McCarthyism in the 1950s. It hit a wall in 1954 when attorney Joseph Welch stood up to McCarthy and said to him, "Have you no sense of decency?" And that was a turning point. Where is a turning point going to be with all of this corporate wokeism, all of this kind of bullyism and telling corporate America what to do, how to act, who to hire, what products to sell? The American people, at some point, and I don't know when it will be, but it will come. I, as the day is long, it will come, where we stand up and say enough is enough. And it'll just, wokeism will be something, if we have this conversation 5 years from now, it's going to be something that's going to be on the sheet of history.
From your lips to God's ears, Charles Mizrahi, and I know that you're using your platform, the Charles Mizrahi Show, among other outlets, to help advance this very important corrective. It can't come too soon, needless to say. Sorry, we're out of time. I hope you'll come back to us again in the near future, if you will, sir. Appreciate your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Professor Ioannis Katoulis about France and its fight with Islamist threats, foreign and domestic, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we are joined for the first time by Dr. Ioannis Katoulis. We've caught up with him in Athens, I believe, where he is an adjunct lecturer in geopolitics at the University of Athens. He has a number of other connections that are of note, particularly to the Investigative Project on Terrorism, terrific outfit here in Washington, D.C., founded by Stephen Emerson. And it was in one of their recent publications that I came across an important article by Dr. Kotolis entitled France, A Battleground Between Secular Values and Turkish Islamism. Dr. Kotolis, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Gaffney, and greetings from Athens, Greece, to you and all your esteemed listeners and our American friends. Thank you very much for your kind invitation to be here today, and we can discuss this subject of the influence of Turkey with the strategic use of Islamist networks, or even, what is most worrying, Islamic communities residing in Europe.
Yes, and beyond, I think. Let's start with France and the fact that the Turkish government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan is now playing a very insidious role inside that country as it, well, influences, one might say, manipulates and radicalizes the migrant, mostly, population. Muslim population of France, some 5.4 million of them, I gather now. Talk a bit about the sort of lay of the land, if you will, in France as a result of all of that.
Of course, France is just an aspect of the general strategy of Turkey. Turkey has adopted a really ambitious self-perception that is the leader of the whole Islamic world. So Turkey wants to appear as kind of representative of Islam in relation to the West. And we should not forget that such a claim by Turkey is kind of based in historical facts. I mean that, after all, the Ottoman Empire was the main historical rival of the West for centuries. I'm trying to explain the self-perception of the Turks, how they act in this matter. So first of all, Turkey...
And in fact, Erdogan does cast himself as the new Ottoman, the new caliphate. Is his aspiration, right?
Exactly. First of all, Turkey has proved its ideological purity, let's say, by affiliating itself with the very matrix of Islamist terrorism, the Muslim Brotherhood. They provide support, or even they host some controversial figures as we currently speak in Turkey. They have their networks. They often collaborate with Hamas, as we know. Second, we could say that Turkey demonstrated its commitment to the Islamist global cause with military support on the ground in Syria or in Libya, or even dispatching some fighters in Azerbaijan. And third, back in the previous year, you had a very symbolic move, which was essential not only for Orthodox Christians, but for Christians in general. They turned the Holy Church of Hagia Sophia in modern-day Istanbul into a mosque.
And these are steps that are now being replicated in a fashion in their exercise of control over mosques elsewhere in Europe, notably, and in France, right?
Transferring the battlefield inside in the interior of Western countries. This is a great card that Erdogan feels he has to play. He tries to take advantage of the existing Islamic populations in general, but of course mostly Turkish ones, in certain countries like France or Germany.
And give us a sense of the magnitude of the control that is being exercised by the Erdogan regime through this agency called the Diyanet.
Yes. Diyanet is a state agency. It's the Directorate of Religious Affairs. It is in charge of controlling mosques and the appointment of imams in mosques in Europe. Initially, it began its activities in Germany, where the majority of Turkish migrants resided. But gradually, with more migration and with differential fertility rates, the percentage, the relative percentage of Turkish citizens in Europe has grown. So now we have this, you know, really strange phenomenon where another country uses a state institution, such as the Diyanet, to control and to appoint imams for actually French citizens, because the Turks living in France are French citizens, and normally they are liable to the French law.
And they're building mosques and they're creating infrastructure for these purposes as well. This has given rise, Professor Ioannis Kotolos, to response by the French government at long last called the Charter of Principles that was enunciated in January. Talk a bit about it, how it's been received by the Turks and their various proxies, and where this leaves France at the moment.
This charter that you mentioned, the Charter of Principles for Islam, was introduced by the French government and the French Council of Muslim Faith. This is the official state-supervised network of Islamic communities. In Europe, as you well know, there is this tradition of state control or anyway state regulation of religious beliefs. So the French authorities back in January announced a general framework for the relations between all this, between the French Islamic communities and the state. So essentially, they tried to fight political Islam, as they define it. And they mention particular groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, the Tablighi Jamaat organization, and the Salafist groups. So this charter tries to introduce a notion of Islam, of Islamic compatibility, let's say, with the values of the French Republic. They actually try to control Islamist networks. They try to avoid what they see is coming. Because, as you know, France is really in a bad situation. You've got suburbs around Paris totally out of the control of the police forces. But most of all, what is most, it's not an issue of order. If that was the problem, it could be solved. Europe has experienced in the past Marxist terrorism, but this was an internal issue, we could say, inside the Western civilization. It was solved. Now this is a totally different situation. It's actually a fight.
Because of the foreign state sponsorship, you're saying?
Yes, of course, and because of the cultural dimension.
And this brings...
You could say that in the past, the USSR also intervened with their networks, but still, this was a kind of discussion inside Western civilization. Even Marxists were part of that civilization. Now it's totally different. It's a religious confrontation. So Turkey's role is essential.
And a culture that is not compatible when it is essentially imbued by this Sharia supremacism with the precepts and traditions and institutions and values of the West. So, Professor, if I may, you've noted that there is an axis of a kind between the left in France and these Islamists. We've called a similar kind of phenomenon here the red-green axis. Talk about its importance to this problem of internal security for France now, as well as the danger of foreign interference.
There is an interesting example of this strange alliance in Strasbourg, which is a city that carries some symbolic weight because it is the seat of the European Parliament, and also it has a magnificent Christian cathedral. So in Strasbourg, we have the greatest mosque, I mean the largest mosque that is currently built in France. When it is completed, it shall be the greatest in France, the Ayoub Sultan Mosque. It is supported by the city authorities, by the municipal authorities of the city, which are controlled by the Greens, the political spectrum of the left. And it is interesting to note that the French interior minister himself, he criticized this action by the city council to support this mosque, because this mosque is actually promoted by Milli Görüş. This is a Turkish Islamist organization,
which has rejected this Charter of Principles, as I understand it, as well. Let me turn quickly, if I may, Professor, to one development that is, very important in all of this, and that is a warning that has been issued by 20 prominent former military leaders of France, 100 or so other officers and 1,000, I guess, military personnel of various ranks, all now out of the service, but basically signaling that they think the crisis with Islamism has come to a point where if action is not taken by the government immediately, that it risks, they didn't quite put it this way, but I think it's the implication, civil war. and draconian steps. Is that correct? A correct reading of their warning, and what do you think it will portend?
So we have this letter by a lot of retired military personnel. It was signed by more than 7,000 people, and but of course the initiative was made by some generals. And this is a warning that France might descend into an outright civil war. They say they have various observations. They refer to the disintegration of France because of the dominant ideology, and I mean this decolonialist mindset that attributes all evils to France itself, to the history of France itself. It's kind of the European equivalent, you know, of this self-hating mentality that is dominant in academic circles, unfortunately, in the West, both in the US and in Europe.
There's much in evidence here at the moment. We've called it the woke culture, among other things, but I think it's downright Marxist. Professor, we are hard out of time, and there's much more to talk with you about. Would you come back to us very soon to continue this conversation, because your insights are so vital, and the fate of France is a canary in the mineshaft, I think, for the rest of Europe and possibly the rest of the free world. Thank you for your time. Thank you for what you've contributed to our understanding of this problem at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, and we will be back to you very soon. Thank you, sir. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about the latest developments in China and what it means for us. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by the great Gordon Chang. He is one of our country's preeminent experts on matters involving, well, our interest in Asia and what they might mean for us if things go seriously wrong. He is the author of numerous books, including The Coming Collapse of China. You see him in all of the right places, including Fox News. We're very pleased to have him as a regular here, and to follow him at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Let's start with some of the things that we were hearing from John Rossomondo a moment ago, Gordon, about the increasing signs, well, for that matter, the explicit testimony of American military leaders that we are seriously challenged, shall we say, when it comes to our ability to defend or help in the defense of Taiwan, should the Chinese Communist Party decide to act on its long-stated ambition to, secure that island's, shall we say, participation in the People's Republic of China going forward. What is your current reading on both the danger that China is poised to act on that aspiration, and how they're reading these kinds of signals out of Washington and elsewhere?
Well, the comments from our military about China ready to attack are mirrored by what people in Beijing are saying. There are a number of voices there who say that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, must annex Taiwan within a five-year time frame. And I think that's what's causing concern among our military and among militaries around the world. There are just these voices that have made it clear that they are preparing to act. And this is mirrored by the almost daily incursions of Chinese aircraft into the Taiwan's air defense identification zone. And we have recently seen the movement of China's first aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, with its support ships going through the Mayoko Straits. And they probably are going to circle around Taiwan. This is an increasingly dangerous situation, Frank.
And would you say, Gordon, that the Chinese Communist Party is reading correctly the attitude of the Biden administration, that it won't be able to or have the will to respond should China act in this manner?
I don't know. I don't know what the Biden administration will do. The Biden administration has done...
No, it's less a question of what they will do, Gordon, than how they're being perceived by Beijing, I guess, that I'm interested in.
Yeah, Beijing actually thinks it owns the Biden administration. And we know this from what we have heard from voices there. They talk about Hunter Biden. They talk about the Wall Street connection. So they believe that they can do whatever they want. Now, that's not to say that they're right, But that is to say, that's their mentality. And because of that, they are emboldened to do things which could trigger conflict.
In part, this is because of past experience with Joe Biden as well. And you've written recently, Gordon, I believe at Gatestone Institute, about the past experience and the present crisis, really, that is now upon us. With respect to the South China Sea, talk a little bit about what Joe Biden did back in 2012 when he had the portfolio for addressing what China was doing, building these bastion islands on uninhabited atolls in the South China Sea, and what is happening today at a place called Whitsun Reef.
Well, Whitsun Reef is about 170, 180 nautical miles from the Philippines. It's within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. It's very far away from China, but we've seen, especially since the first week of March, about 220 Chinese fishing trawlers and other vessels in tight formation around Whitsun, preventing Philippine fishermen from going there. And this is reminiscent of what happened in early 2012 around Scarborough Shoal, which is even closer to the Philippines than Whitsun is. Scarborough was important because it guards the mouths to both Manila and Subic Bays. And in early that year, we saw both Chinese and Philippine vessels crowd around that feature to prevent a confrontation. The Obama administration actually brokered a deal between Manila and Beijing for both sides to withdraw their craft. Only the Philippines complied, leaving China in control of Scarborough. The administration did not enforce the agreement it brokered, and China's then did something which is important, because we talk about the fortification of those islands and the Spratlys that occurred just months after the failure of the Obama administration at Scarborough. China then ramped up pressure on other Philippine features in the South China Sea, and then China then started to go after the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, which both Japan and China claim, but which Japan is in control of. So really what China did was it made the problem bigger, because the Obama administration, by refusing to enforce the deal that it put together, just emboldened the worst elements in the Chinese political system by showing everybody that aggression in fact worked. We're seeing the same series of events play out at Whitsun. We don't know what the Biden team will do, but this is exceedingly dangerous because, as you point out, Frank, it's the mentality of the Chinese rulers that is really the critical issue here.
Unfortunately, the Biden team today, starting with, of course, the commander-in-chief, is pretty much the Biden team that was in place back in 2012, was it not? And doesn't that really further exacerbate the problem you talked about a moment ago, Gordon, which is that the Chinese think they own this administration? And whether it's a misperception or whether it's a correct assessment, they seem to think they can have their way with us. And that's a very dangerous development. And talk about why, Gordon, it's dangerous. These places seem very far removed. I suspect most Americans couldn't find them on a map. But what are the implications for us if these claims and actual seizing of areas of the South China Sea, to say nothing of Taiwan, actually were to eventuate, as you suggest they may?
Well, right now at this moment, Frank, we are seeing, as we mentioned, the Chinese sortie, that carrier group of theirs. Also at the same time, the Mustin, which is an Arleigh Burke destroyer, is sailing off the coast of Shanghai. And the Theodore Roosevelt carrier strike group just entered the South China Sea through the Malacca Straits. So we're seeing a lot of naval forces enter into generally the same area. This is exceedingly dangerous when that occurs, because that is an essential element of conflict. And to answer your earlier point, it was Kurt Campbell, then at the State Department, who was the one in the Obama administration who negotiated that deal between Manila and Beijing over Scarborough. And now in the Biden administration, it is Kurt Campbell who is the Asia czar. So we are seeing many of the same faces from the Obama national security team in the Biden one.
Yeah, and Blinken and Sullivan and on and on. It's ominous. And I guess the point I was trying to get at, Gordon, is if the South China Sea actually falls under Chinese control, if Taiwan actually is annexed by China, the repercussions are going to be very far-reaching, economically, commercially, as well as in terms of geopolitical development. No?
It could very well be the end of America's role in the world, not just in Asia, because countries not only in the region, but in Europe and all other places are looking at this as a question of American resolve, whether we can defend the global commons. Remember, our notion is that there's international waters, international airspace, everyone gets to use them, and that there is global commerce. That won't be the case if China starts closing off large bodies of water, because other countries will do the same. We're going to head to a very different world, Frank. So everything is at stake.
You know, we've talked in the past with Kevin Freeman and spoke with him earlier in the program today a little bit about the pressure on the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, on which really, I think, our economy now vitally depends, given what we've done to essentially mortgage our future to our ability to print more money with impunity. What we're talking about here, Gordon, is the possibility that if countries around the world, as Kevin likes to say, cease to think that we are going to defend them, that's another powerful incentive to make an adjustment that many of them are tempted to make anyway, getting out of dollars that are increasingly less and less valuable. This is a problem that I believe bears the most urgent of attention for all of the reasons we've discussed, and we appreciate so much your helping illuminate what's at stake. Let me ask you quickly in closing, Gordon, about one other thing that you've written about also at Gatestone, about the role that the Chinese are now playing in the drug offensive, really. It's not just a war. It's an offensive against our country out of Mexico and the cartels there. Talk about what Chinese money changers, money launderers are up to, and why that's so important for us as well.
Well, Chinese gangs are taking over the international money laundering. So, for instance, there was a gang based in Guadalajara that was money laundering for the Sinaloa cartel and for other Mexican drug groups. Basically, what this has done is with the, certainly with the knowledge and probably with the consent of Beijing, because these Chinese gangs use Chinese financial apps and burner phones to move money through the Chinese financial system. The United States has asked for cooperation from Beijing on this, for instance, this Guadalajara-based Chinese gang, and has and Beijing has refused all help. So it's really an issue where we're seeing Chinese gangs, not only in Mexico and Latin America, but elsewhere, take over money laundering businesses with Beijing's assistance.
Yeah, making them more efficient and more effective in getting their product into our country to our great detriment, which I guess can be said of fentanyl as well, another area where the Chinese are not cooperating. Gordon Chang, thank you for helping us understand and really calibrate the challenge that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party each week. We appreciate it so much and look forward to our visit with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend, and keep up the great work that you do.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And it's a special pleasure to say welcome to one of my dearest friends and closest colleagues. Her name is Reggie Littlejohn. She is the inspiring founder and leader of a great organization called Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She's also a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, and in both of those capacities, she has been a leading force behind a new initiative of these two organizations. That is something we touched on a moment ago with Gordon Chang, namely trying to ensure that the world does not make the mistake that it made in 1936 when it legitimated, empowered, and I think unquestionably emboldened a totalitarian regime. At the time, it was called the Third Reich in Adolf Hitler's Germany by allowing, in this case, Olympic Games to be held as they were back in 1936 in Berlin, now in February of 2022 in Beijing, China. Reggie, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us to talk about this really important endeavor. And let's start by setting the stage for why it's ill-advised under the circumstances for the games to be held there, and the important letters that you and Brian Kennedy have sent, among others, to warn the U.S. Olympic Committee about that mistake.
Thank you for having me on, Frank. And you were a big part of those letters, too. So thank you for your leadership on this issue as well. So the United States, under Secretary of State Pompeo and even the new Secretary of State Blinken, have both said that China is committing genocide in Xinjiang. And one of the big ways that they are committing it is through forced abortion, forced sterilization, and infanticide, as well as the internment of Uyghur Muslims and forced organ harvesting. You know, they have so many human rights abuses, to say nothing of the fact that they are still forcibly aborting and sterilizing women under the two-child policy. So we just think that that under the Genocide Convention, to which the United States is a signatory, that once an official genocide determination has gone out, we are required under that convention to punish the perpetrators. And so far from punishing China, allowing them to have the Olympics is almost like rewarding them for their conduct, or it is at least saying we're going to turn a blind eye to this, and we don't care if you are murdering millions of your own citizens. You know, we're just going to honor you by giving you the most prestigious international event in the world. And that's wrong.
It's wrong. And we've seen, I think, as I said, in that historical model, how wrong it can prove to be if you do indeed embolden these murderous thugs to think that they can get away with, well, murder, yes, genocide even, and perhaps world domination, if that's their aspiration. And it certainly is true of the Chinese Communist Party, as you know, Reggie Littlejohn. So in the first letter that was sent to the U.S. Olympic Committee, you laid out, along with some, 100 plus signatories, myself included, a litany of crimes against humanity that the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in. The letter actually describes them, I think accurately, as a transnational criminal organization. Talk a bit about the impetus behind going ahead with these Olympics. Who are the sorts of people and companies that are confronting this effort to move the Olympics elsewhere so as not to dignify, not to legitimate, not to empower and embolden the CCP?
Well, I mean, are you talking about the Olympic sponsors, the ones who are sponsoring the Olympics? Well, the corporate sponsors of the 2020 Olympics are some huge names like Airbnb and Coca-Cola and Omega and Panasonic and Toyota, and there's a list of them. Dow, General Electric. I mean, these are big names. Now, in all fairness, they said that they would sponsor the Olympic Games before there was an official determination of genocide. But now that there has been a determination of genocide, we are calling upon them to boycott the Games, to withdraw their sponsorship. Otherwise, you know, the same argument applies to them. Are they standing with, you know, possibly the greatest human rights violators in the world today, as opposed to standing with a victim?
In the world ever, I think it's fair to say.
I mean, if you go by just the sheer numbers, I mean, even if you just talk about the one-child policy, 400 million forced abortions, that eclipses, just in numbers, all of the atrocities that are happening in the world today. And it's the biggest atrocity that's ever happened in the history of the world, just in terms of the massive scale of it.
So, Reggie, we're looking at corporate interests. We're looking at the Olympic committees. We're looking at, inevitably, just sheer logistical arguments. This is a big undertaking. There does seem, however, to be a growing sense around the world, certainly in the United States, that the Chinese are up to no good. In my previous conversation with Gordon, we talked about, among other things, their metastasizing social credit system that is enabling you know, the kind of control of populations that they're anxious to export, not just apply to their own people. But do you think that this has the potential actually to reach critical mass and essentially compel the movement of these games to somewhere in the free world where they can be freedom games, as I said, instead of genocide games?
Well, Frank, I think that there is a growing movement, and there are people in the U.S. government and there are other organizations. I just discovered one this week, another organization that is pressing to boycott the game. And
this is Jason Jones' effort, I believe,
no,
right?
No, it's another one besides that. So I guess I could say that there are two other organizations that I have discovered just this week. So this is a groundswell that's happening in all kinds of places, and we're finding out about each other. And if we can band together, then we can put them in a position where it would be very difficult for them to just go forward with sending our athletes to those games. And I feel sorry for the athletes, Frank. I mean, because, you know, these athletes, they have consciences too, and they shouldn't be forced, like women, female athletes should not be forced to compete on the soil where so much blood of 400 million women in forced abortions has flowed. And, you know, so here they are,
countless other sexual crimes against women that go beyond just the abortion business, of course. But this raises another question, which I touched on briefly with Gordon, and I'd like to just ask you about too. You're absolutely right. These people have devoted their lives in many cases to, you know, honing their skills in various sporting activities. And they don't want to, we don't want to deprive them of the international recognition that would go with competing in the Olympics. But on the other hand, there may also be real costs to them. I mean, quite apart from sort of dignifying, legitimating these oppressive communist thugs. Talk a little bit, if you could, about the possibility that, you know, their own personal, well, DNA may be expropriated by the Chinese as part of their participation. And I don't know if you know much about this transhumanism business, but it does seem to me it's entirely predictable that they will be contributing to efforts by the Chinese Communist Party to build superhumans, not just for sports purposes, but probably for warfare as well. This is an appalling thought. I can't imagine that American athletes would want to be party to that.
Well, that's right. So the thing is, the Chinese Communist Party are notorious eugenicists. They practice eugenics, okay? And they're not apologetic about it.
Define that term just for all of us who are not ignorant of what it really means.
Eugenics is what it is it's trying to create a quote unquote better population. So what they do is they will, not allow people who are disabled in certain ways to even have children. All right. I've seen.
So they're purging them. And they're trying to build new ones. And again, all of this is of a horrific character. And Reggie, unfortunately, we're out of time to discuss it further at the moment, but I hope you'll come back to us with updates about this. And in particular, the rally that we will be holding on the 29th of May in Colorado Springs to talk specifically to the athletes and to the U.S. Olympic Committee about the importance of moving the games, not holding them in China, not making this Berlin 1936 all over again. How can people contribute to this effort, Reggie?
Go to genocidegames.org. That's genocidegames.org and sign our petition. We would like to get 100,000 signatures.
Thank you for your leadership at Women's Rights Without Frontiers, Reggie, and your participation in the Committee on the Present Danger China. We'll talk with you again very soon. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.